This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Welcome back to Such Sights to Show, an all things Clive Barker podcast. I'm Joe Lipsett, and I'm joined as always by Mr. Brian Christopher. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing today?
Well, I don't have every dead person's name written all over my body, so I think I'm doing better than at least one of the characters in this here text.
Yeah. I want to have something cool and snarky to say, but like, I think our problem with this movie is going to be that it doesn't even instill enough nerd crankiness to be shitty about it.
It's true. Yeah. So folks, we're talking about Books of Blood from 2020. This is, in quotation marks, an adaptation of two different Clive Barker short stories from the Books of Blood. And I'm saying quotation marks because these are pretty loose. So what we have is what Clive Barker is on record as an anti-anthology, which is, in my mind, very similar to Michael Dougherty's Trick or Treat.
Yep. Yeah. And I think anytime you do things that will draw comparisons to Trick or Treat, you are really taking a swing. Because if you do not get it right, then you are just going to have people watching your movie hoping it was Trick or Treat, or wishing it was Trick or Treat. And I think that was kind of where I was with this. Like, I got where they were going. I appreciated that they were connecting the threads. But honestly, Joe, when I was done with this movie, my biggest question was, you have this deep well of source material to pull from. With these really great stories that are like quintessential Clive Barker, because they're written by Clive Barker. It is stuff he was doing early in his career where he was making a name for himself. Mm-hmm. So you have these really interesting stories and you, for the most part, don't use them. Mm-mm. And that just baffles me. Absolutely baffles me, especially as we learn more and realize to the degree to which Clive Barker himself was involved.
Yeah, which is wild, because if you look at it from just a glimpsing on Wikipedia or IMDb, you're going to see that this is directed by Brennan Braga, and it was co-written by Braga as well as Adam Simon. So initially, I didn't even realize Barker was involved in this at all, but if you start to do a little bit of digging, you'll learn some fun facts. So originally, this was intended to be an ongoing television show. It was never intended originally as an anthology film. And Braga was working with Clive Barker. So Barker had something like 30 different script treatments that he was in development on. Some of them were adaptations of Books of Blood stories. Others were original writing that he was thinking, oh, this could make sense in terms of an ongoing television show. And then basically, if you kind of read between the lines, it sounds like Hulu said, well, why don't we start with this anti-anthology as a film? And then if it does well, we can do future versions as films as well. So like, this would have been the start of something if it had performed. And by all indications, it did not. So this is a one and done.
Yeah, I mean, it's only got a 21% on Rotten Tomatoes, which, you know, we all know isn't the end-all, be-all metric of this kind of stuff. But
important to remember, it's an aggregator, so it's not as though, like, 21% of people think that it's good and everybody else thinks it's bad. But, I mean, I would say I'm in the same boat as you. This is meh. It's fine. It's perfectly serviceable, but it's also ultimately very forgettable.
Yeah, and when you're setting the standard of calling it the Books of Blood, you know, again, I think that is going to lead you in with certain expectations. And I honestly would have thought, based off of what I saw, that Barker just kind of signed off on like, yep, you can use the name 100%. Rights. And then y'all do whatever you want with it, because it just seems like, it just seems like this has more fingerprints of Adam Simon and Brandon Braga than to me it does Barker at all. And absolutely. I don't say that necessarily knowing like the style of Braga or Simon, just that this ain't Barker for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not provocative. I mean,
no.
I'm interested, and we don't need to have the conversation right now, but I would before the end of this recording like to tackle how you feel this compares to the other Barker Hulu property, which is, of course, the contemporary Hellraiser film. Because in looking at it, I was like, well, at least that one's trying something. You know, it doesn't 100% work for us, but this one, it feels so milquetoast. It's like Barker for dummies, people who have never read his work, people who don't know how provocative he can be. And instead, this is so safe.
Yeah. And I think it really starts off with, and did we have any other table setting we need to do before we start talking about the stories? Because for me, like, it really starts with the first story in terms of where things go off the rails.
Yeah. No, let's jump right into it.
Okay, so the story is framed. So it's kind of weird because it's framed with what you think is just going to be a simple like framing narrative where you get these two what look to be kind of like hitmen or something like that. So you think it's going to be, okay, we see the beginning, we see them at the end. But it's woven in a little bit more. Again, they're going for that trick-or-treat thing. So you see them kind of come in and out of stories. I think it's a little clunky, but we'll get to that later. But the first story proper is just called Jenna, because basically the framing that they're using is the names of the people that wind up on the Book of Blood or in the Book of Blood.
Yes.
And so Jenna is a college student suffering from mental illness who runs away after being noncompliant with her medication. She begins to suspect that someone is following her and takes refuge at a bed and breakfast. So this story takes up about half the movie, like this one vignette. So there are three vignettes. This one that I think the entire runtime is about an hour and 47 minutes, about 45 to 50 minutes of the movie is this story.
Yeah.
And
this is an original story that was just created for the film.
And it is so outside of the realm of like that Barker flavor. There are interesting elements to it. I don't know to what degree I would like it more if my brain wasn't attaching it to something that should be more Barkery.
Yeah.
But it was also just it seemed very paint by numbers. Like I knew where it was going very early on.
Right.
You know, we get Jenna winding up at this idyllic, too good to be true bed and breakfast where there is this older couple who is running things. The woman is very into like herbs and gardening. And you start to see Jenna is having like these bizarre dreams and having like sleep paralysis. You're very quickly putting two and two together on like, she's poisoning people. Like, they're poisoning people. And they are, you know, there's something nefarious going on. And sure enough, you know, we find out that they've kind of been doing, like, a people under the stairs kind of a thing. Where they are taking these various travelers. They are sewing their eyes shut, taking their tongues, and keeping them trapped in various compartments that are kind of, like, built into the walls of the house.
Yeah.
So, like, almost ripping off people under the stairs now that I think about it.
Yeah, the only surprise with this one is I expected that they were just killing people and putting them in the garden, you know, like Mother's Day or something. So it's a bit wild that we're using some dead bodies as fertilizer, for sure. We're dumping others in a big, like, industrial ravine where people are doing, like, mining and stuff. But for the most part, this is almost a humanitarian effort for Ellie. That's the woman who runs this B&B with her husband. They look for lost souls or people who are in pain. So this is a Black Widow kind of thing. But yeah, the problem is that it's pretty evident pretty early what's going on. And then you just have to wait for it to unfold and then wait a bit more.
and a bit more, and eventually get to the point where if you're like me, you start hitting that jump forward 10 seconds button that Hulu has. Like, honestly, it was to the point where I'm just like, I know where this is going. Please just get there. Mm-hmm. You know, and I am not the most astute observer. So I always see it as like, if I know where this is going, you are really doing a bad job at hiding your hand, because mm-hmm. like I usually will be the person who will just go along for the ride and not be necessarily great about like predicting where the narrative is going to go.
Yeah, well, it's an important to note, too, that Jenna's story is kind of broken up, right? I mean, she has a mental illness where everything that she hears is hurting her mentally. So it sounds like people chewing, other people's music, everything just seems heightened and super loud. So she has to use sound deafening headphones to get any kind of peace. So she is living in a kind of pain. And over the course of the story, we come to learn that she has a really troubled past. And we think that she was stalked by a boy in her class. His father is now in pursuit of her to try to get a sense of what happened, because the boy has since died. And it's revealed after we break Jenna's story, go to another story, come back, that Jenna actually encouraged him to die by suicide. And now she feels bad. And to me, that was the most interesting part of the story.
Yeah.
But it feels like it's actually all just there so that we can get this sort of sad but sort of happy ending where she willingly goes back to Ellie to be put into a box in the ground with her, you know, eyes taken out, tongue removed, and ears sewn shut. And she finally finds the peace that she's been looking for. But it doesn't work for me, in part because the first part of the story takes too long to tell, but also that piece with her feeling bad about goading this boy to suicide, we haven't spent enough time with that, so the ending doesn't feel earned.
No, yeah, there's a lot of reasons why that doesn't work for me. Everything you said, I agree with. It also doesn't work as a framing device.
Not really.
We're looking at this through the lens of, well, the Books of Blood is the framing device. Mm-hmm. So
we have two framing devices.
Yeah. Well, you might even argue like three, like, because we do start off with Bennett, the hitman. Like, he's actually mm-hmm. the first person you see. He winds up being the last story, but not like the thread. Like, all of these stories are both stories and framing devices. And again, it is trying to go for that trick or treat, like, weave together threads and narratives, but the seams show so much more in this. And it does not come together nearly as in as satisfying a way as it does in Trick or Treat.
Yeah. So the Bennett storyline is based on Jerusalem Street, which, of course, is one of the Books of Blood. And it's one that you and I just read, right? You know, it's the hitman who goes and tries to collect the Book of Blood, and it ends up killing him. And in some ways, I was like, okay, well, that makes sense that it's so brief in the film then. You know, it was the framing device in the Books of Blood, so it was also quite short. Mm-hmm. The problem is that it's not interesting, and this character sucks. I don't like him. I don't like this story at all. So, like, technically one of the three stories that we're telling and one of the two proper adaptations kind of blows.
Yeah. And is also the way it's adapted, it veers away from what was potentially a very interesting visual in terms of the hitman in the book or in the story getting drowned by the blood, just kind of getting unleashed in a torrent from the skin that he takes from Simon. But they don't actually have that sequence happen. They leave Simon as the Book of Blood is still kind of a dangling thread in this, because I guess they were hoping for more movies.
Yes.
But it's not satisfying as a framing device, because if we are basing all of this on the Books of Blood, then your Book of Blood should be the framing device. And they keep bringing things back to Jenna, which I don't understand, like, on any level, that they think that she would be the most interesting part, that it somehow for them works as a satisfying narrative. Like, none of it makes sense to take this element that wasn't part of the Books of Blood to begin with, shoehorn it in and make it your centerpiece of the entire movie. Like, everything comes back to Jenna, and I don't give a fuck about Jenna. I'm sorry. I just don't.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on record as not being a fan of Britt Robertson. I feel like she's been given far too many opportunities to break out in Hollywood, and she always delivers this kind of performance. Much like the film, she's often fine or meh or okay, but she's never great, and sometimes she's bad. Here, I think Jenna could be an interesting character. I don't know if it's a combination of not well-written or meh performance, but she doesn't jump off the screen, in part because she's a wah-wah character who, you know, she's troubled, she's suffering, so it has to fit that, but also we're spending just altogether too much time with her. But then let's talk about the other adaptation, which is Miles in the film, and of course this is based on Barker's story, Book of Blood, which mm-hmm. is the one that offers the other framing device. So this is how the Books of Blood opens in volume one. And it purports to, yes, introduce this idea of stories of the dead written on a man's body. And you could argue this is the most successful. It's the one that feels simultaneously a little too long and a little too brief for how we're using it in the film. Mm-hmm. But I almost wonder if they shot themselves in the foot by including this and then choosing not to use it as the framing device. Like, I think in some ways it's too obvious to use as the framing device because then you really are just doing what Barker did. But also by having it, and if anybody knows that, then it feels like they're misusing it.
I mean, this one is my favorite of the three. I mean, that's not a very high, you know, benchmark. Yeah. But it is the one that I think works the best. And huge shock, the one that lines up most with Barker's original vision. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's the one that seems to work the best. Maybe it is too obvious to use that as the framing reference, but like sometimes obvious, like you're allowed to go for the obvious choice. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like using this as a framing device. Could have just been like, okay, we're going to set the table. We're going to do something similar to what Barker did. And we're going to open up with this story so that we can then say like, okay, all the other stories are coming from what we're reading on Simon's body. Like, mm-hmm. make it simple. It's allowed to be simple. It doesn't need to be too cute for its own good, which I think is where they get into trouble here.
Right. Okay. So question for you then. Mm-hmm. So would you have preferred that we do this but keep it briefer, or are you satisfied with this actually having its own chapter? Because, you know, we've mentioned, okay, so Simon is the person who has everything written on him, but that's the sort of Twilight Zone, trick-or-treat-esque twist that comes at the end of the story, right? So mm-hmm. we still have to go through Mary, who is a scientist who is skeptical, she debunks people, and then Simon is the con artist who pretends that he can communicate with her dead child, and they have this faux romance, and then she tries to take it grand scale, and he gets drunk and confesses, oh, it was all just a con, and then the spirits come for him, and they turn him into a real supernatural artifact. Did you like that as a story, or would you have preferred that we just open kind of where we see Bennett, which is he comes upon this man who is just covered in supernatural writing?
I could see a shortened version of this story opening the movie. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And ideally, if we're looking at this in a dream scenario where I'm steering the ship and, mm-hmm. you know, this is a TV series. Right. And we open with maybe a truncated version of Mary and Simon. And then we establish that as a framing device. And I feel like there's an opportunity then to kind of keep telling more of Mary and Simon's story as okay. mm-hmm. they're kind of introducing the next story, like the next vignette or the next episode.
Okay.
So, you know, something where there is this, that balance between having a long arc between those two and, mm-hmm. and kind of what's going on there, and then having like the episode of the week, you know, so, and for me, this is kind of within the context of this still being a TV show.
Right. Okay.
And even if we're keeping this as a movie, then I am doing something where it's more shorter stories mm-hmm. and still getting little teases or little kind of narrative threads that push along Mary and Simon, and then like maybe devoting like 15 to 20 minutes a vignette for the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which might be, you know, might also be a tall order in terms of, you know, one of the things we talked about a lot with a lot of these stories from Barker is that they are beasts of short stories. So yes, it might not be as simple as reducing them down to 15 to 20 minute vignettes. But
mm-hmm.
I can say at least the structure would be a little bit neater, where just use them to introduce it, use kind of in between little pieces of them interacting and kind of mm-hmm. telling more of their story to introduce the next vignette.
Yeah. I mean, as you were talking, I was reflecting back on a TV show that I used to watch as a preteen. It was called Nightmare Cafe, and it was an anthology TV show of sorts. So it followed a number of people who worked at a late night diner just off the highway. And it was always sort of mysterious circumstances of where is this set? It's only seemingly open at night. It's always dark out and so on. And customers would come in and they would get told a story, or they would tell their story. And then mm-hmm. the rest of the episode would be taken up with that. So it was an anthology of sorts, but every episode, the consistent factor was the people who worked in the diner. So you would have your special guests and their story, but you would learn things about the cook and the waitress and the diner owner and that kind of stuff. It was never super highbrow. Like, it wasn't as if we really developed a mythology or told a story arc with these characters. I can't even remember how long the show ran for, but it was definitely one of those, you know, this was your consistency point. This was your anchor. And then we were free to tell other stories that could either be in a similar vein or not. It could be completely different. And it feels like that's a model that works, where you're able to dedicate enough time that you could tell a really juicy Clive Barker novella.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's a two-parter, or you could do like, here's two customers back to back and we're doing, you know, 15 to 20 minutes and each person gets something with the regular crew. And then we mm-hmm. go on to the next episode.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I would do.
It feels like they overcomplicated things, and I'm mm-hmm. not entirely sure why. And I'm not entirely sure how much of this was driven by their actual creative decisions versus Hulu taking a look and saying, ooh, we're not ready to commit to a TV show. We don't actually want to do this. So can you just turn this into a film and just finesse it?
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder to what degree they had, like, maybe an entire season worth of stuff planned. And mm-hmm. then Hulu comes back and goes, like, okay, but no. Fit this into 2 hours?
Yeah, exactly.
And if you do it right, like, and we get a lot of views on it, like, then maybe we'll give you more. Mm-hmm. You know, which would make sense, because to a degree, it looks like they are trying to leave enough open for there to be additional installments.
Oh, sure.
But they yeah. also look like they're trying to bring it to some kind of a fulfilling close. I don't know how effective they are in that.
Mm-hmm.
So we get Jenna's story, which takes 45 to 50 minutes. We get Miles, the middle story with Mary and Simon, which I think is probably, what do you think, like 20, 20? 25 minutes, something yeah. like that. And then Bennett gets like,
maybe 10
yeah 10 to 15 a little bit more, like it depends on how much you consider, because his stuff transitions back into Ellie and Sam and back to Jenna again.
Yeah.
And kind of like Bennett does come back to the house, but we find out is where Mary and Simon are.
Mm-hmm.
But they just kind of go off by the wayside in terms of like,
yeah,
we don't really get any resolution to what's going on there, which I think is where the attempt is to be like, well, they're still there, so we can do more of these because the Book of Blood still exists.
Yeah, exactly. That house is still there. They're still hanging out.
Yeah.
You know, if Ellie and her people under the stairs house gets discovered, it's not a big deal because that's its own part of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. Another interesting element is the fact that like Ellie and Sam don't get a comeuppance. Like they win basically. And yeah. you know, which I guess also goes to the idea, you know, one of the things that we've talked about is like likable versus unlikable characters. And I think this is a movie filled with I guess you could say unlikable. At best flawed, but in a lot of cases, unlikable characters. And so it's hard to like, you're not really rooting for anybody in this one.
No, I mean, I think the closest person that I was really rooting for was Gavin, who is the other guest in Ellie's house that forms a tentative connection with Jenna. And we don't even get to see what happens to him. We see him in a box at one point. It's like, oh, that's why he didn't make their coffee date, because he's already underground. And I think it's meant to be this really sad moment, but also we barely knew this kid. So it's like, I don't know, maybe we would have circled back in a later version and featured him in a story. But even then, I'm thinking, I don't know that I need more of this Ellie and Sam story, because this isn't the place the story should be going back to repeatedly.
Yeah. It's funny because it's almost going to that kind of reveal, and that kind of format is actually kind of getting more into like Tales from the Crypt territory. Than Clive Barker stories. And I would say that, you know, the way these things resolve are kind of in a similar vein as Tales from the Crypt, but they're not nearly as playful or as intentionally campy as Tales from the Crypt. You know, usually Tales from the Crypt and all those EC comics, like, it is usually filled with like kind of terrible people.
But it's morality stories.
Yeah, they're all getting their comeuppance in these really like poetically gruesome ways. And that just doesn't. That's not like, yes, Jenna's ending is, there is some poetic justice there, but there's nothing playful or fun about it. It's just kind of sad.
Yeah. I wonder to what extent this is a tone issue. In part, it sounds like we both struggled because, as always, we have expectations of what constitutes a quintessential Clive Barker text, right? You know, we're going into this saying, oh, okay, so you're not even doing adaptations of these great stories. You're doing a couple and then something new, and it doesn't mesh well together, but you're also not really capturing the sexy tone. You're not capturing the dangerous or provocative tone. You're not doing the weird whimsical stuff that every once in a while sneaks into one of those volumes. It feels to me like Braga has some good ideas, but I think there's an immediate barrier if you know Barker at all, where you're just like, this is not right. You are not nailing this correctly. This feels like something else, and it's just a horror anthology, but where's the Barker?
And it just seemed like there was an overall lack of enthusiasm. Like, there's no energy coming from this movie.
No. I think that's why it's so meh, right? It's so forgettable, because it's fine. Like, the gore is fine. The performances are fine. The visual look is fine. But also, there's nothing that stands out about this. Like, it played at a couple of different festivals. I would have been really interested to see this with an audience, or if you had to pay for it, because I think that would have been a no-go for me.
Yeah, I think I would have been actively annoyed if I had paid money for this movie. Because, yeah, honestly, I think as we talk about it, it's the energy that's missing from this.
Yeah.
Nothing about it is incompetent, but no one involved looks like they really have like a passion to be there.
Yeah, like, so Trace and I just did an episode on Horror Queers about Scooby-Doo, and we talked about how so many different iterations of that IP, you know, it's lived on for 75 years, and it's been done by a bunch of different people. But the people who do it always seem to have an encyclopedic knowledge of the history. They have like a love for the characters. You know, they're always trying something new. They want to be reverential, but also break new ground and stuff. And this very much feels like, Braga, did you know Clive Barker? Like, it seems like you were in conversations. It seems like they were writing together, but you can't see any of that enthusiasm or that love on the screen. Like, this feels like somebody read a plot synopsis of the whole six volumes of Books of Blood and then said, cool, so dead people stories written on a guy, go.
Yeah. No, this has a very 9-to-5, like, journeyman, like, okay, we're going to get this done.
Right.
We're going to get it done on time and like within budget and then good enough, call it a day.
Exactly. I got to get home for like dinner with the wife and maybe a slice of pie. Yeah, yeah. I'm actually really disappointed because Trace and I did cover this on the Horror Queers Patreon, and I remember feeling quite ambivalent about it, but I was hoping I was going to have a different reaction, A, knowing what it is, and B, having the conversation with you, because we're both kind of Barker heads. And I finished this. It took me 3 sittings because I just kind of kept pausing in between stories to go and do other things. But yeah, I left it and I just felt so ambivalent. Like, yeah, that is middle of the road. And I don't think I would ever rewatch this again unless somebody gave me a reason to.
Well, you're welcome.
I'm sad because I was actually hopeful you would come back and be like, it's good. And I thought we could have a conversation. And then you were like, well, that's a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. That all happened. And I think to the point you hinted at earlier about the Hellraiser remake.
Yeah,
we both agree that the Hellraiser remake wasn't really our speed, but I will 100% give David Bruckner and crew credit for trying something and trying to do something where they were being in some way faithful to the material while taking a swing of some kind.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it might not have all worked for you and I, but there are a lot of people who I do think genuinely appreciated it for what they were doing. Mm-hmm. I feel like this movie, Books of Blood, isn't going to be divisive because I don't think anybody's going to care enough about it one way or the other.
Yeah, like, does this movie have staunch defenders who live and die on the hill of saying, people, you got to watch this. You're missing out if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
I feel like it just could not inspire that level of passion. I think there's probably a lot of people like you and I watched it. Cool. Did that. Moving on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I will take a movie like the Hellraiser remake 10 times out of 10. Even if I don't personally prefer it, I appreciate people who are going to try something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like even the audacity to cast Jamie Clayton as the Hell Priest, like that is a big swing. I'm not seeing big swings here.
Yeah, no, not at all. And, you know, you can't even make the argument that, like, I don't think it was a budget issue because I think the swings that they were taking in the Hellraiser remake weren't necessarily due to, like, getting big names. Like, I think the biggest name they had was Goran...
Vincheck, yeah.
Vincheck, yeah. So, you know, I don't think we were talking about, like, huge budgetary constraints being the issue here. You know, I think it was just David Bruckner had a better sense for better sense of the material and how he was going to give it some personality.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, I would even argue the level of production looks about the same. Like I wouldn't be surprised to hear that the budget was similar between the two. And yet there were moments in the Hellraiser remake that completely stand out to me. Like it was top of mind for certain categories at the Hereditaries, which is our horror Oscar pool. You know, those performances, I think about a lot of them in various ways. Like I wish we got a sequel to that one because I wanted to see what they were going to do next. If only because that felt like a cool, now we've set the stage, we've built the foundation, let's go. And Book of Blood is the exact same thing. Like, we clearly were hoping to set the stage and build the foundation, and we were going to do more things. But I don't have any level of excitement. Like, I don't feel bad that we didn't get another entry in this, because I honestly think it would have probably been more of the same.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't feel robbed by not getting subsequent installments of the Books of Blood.
Which is a colossal shame, because I think about the conversations we've had about the various short stories and maybe not doing them one for one, but even more in that flavor, or cherry picking better stories from that collection. Because I'm not going to lie, the ones that they picked are also not the ones I would have, like, that would not have been my first choice of the 2 stories they did adapt.
Yeah, no, not at all. And again, I don't think that's something you can blame on budgetary constraints, because, yeah, he's got some that are a little bit more fantastical and would have taken some bigger budgets, but he's got some smaller stories in there. Like, tell me they could not have done, and I forget what it's called, but the one that takes place in the motel complex,
right,
where you have like the ghosts and you have like the preacher, like the traveling televangelist and his wife. Like, that could have been a very small story that would not have taken a lot of budget. It wouldn't have not taken like a lot of resources. And it's one that I think fits well in like being able to give maybe a playful tone a little bit to an anthology series and being able to mix it up a little bit, which I think goes against that idea of them trying to go for that anti-anthology where everything is kind of connected.
Right.
But, you know, again, you're taking a risk with that, where if someone doesn't connect with what you're going for and you just lean into that the entire time, which is what they did here, then yeah, there aren't any like bright spots for people to be able to say, well, at least this worked, you know, not everything worked, but at least this does. But if it's all the same, then ugh.
No, Brian, we would just have Jenna go to that motel and she would be our entry point into that story. So you could keep Jenna, your favorite character.
Yeah, just suck all the air out of that story, too.
Okay. Well, I think that'll about do it for Books of Blood. Mr. Brian, if people want to challenge you and say, no, Jenna was a great anchor point for this film, how would they get in touch?
I would be super surprised, but you can get me at Blue Sky or Instagram at Evil Taylor Hicks. I am not going to hold my breath for those ats to start coming my way, though.
They're going to pour in. You're going to be surprised.
So if people want to reach out to you and say why they thought that Mary and Simon had all kinds of chemistry and we just completely missed it, where would they reach out to you?
Oh boy. Yes. I welcome that treatise. I give you reach to B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B. And of course, you can, well, not get both of us, but you can follow the show on the feed at the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network. So make sure that you are subscribing and liking and doing reviews and other things like that, because that is helpful. But Mr. Brian, this is not the end of Such Sights to Show, because of course I was informed by listener Eric Riley that there's actually a second iteration of Books of Blood. This one is from 2009 and it's simply called Book of Blood. So I think we should absolutely check that out next.
I am fully on board with that. I'm going to be interested to see, like, you know, if we do a side by side on this, I'll be like, this 2009 version has to be more interesting than what we just watched, right? Please. I can't do this again.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say, I don't know, and we're going to find out. So tune in next time, folks.
Fingers crossed.
Squad.